Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you so much to Maxime, to Antoine, to Sylvia, to Stéphane for this honor. I'm so sorry to, I feel embarrassed to speak in English, but I need to because I do have a little bit of French, but not very much. So you have to bear with me with my English presentation. It's really wonderful to be on this panel because I think there are various themes which we'll hopefully pick up in the conversation. We're all interested in material culture. And one of the things I was thinking about is that there is a sensory aspect to my paper, which might be interesting to discuss. I don't think I discussed the nose, but I'm interested in the senses, and there are other senses which will hopefully appear here, which I think are important to think through in relation to oceanic landscapes, maybe particularly. And then the fragmentary came up in Juan's paper, and I'm wondering whether I'm using the fragment differently to you, so we may want to talk about that. I think the things I'm talking about in this paper can also be invisible and suddenly visible, but I understood from your presentation that it's partly the temporality, that it suddenly appears and, you know, and so forth. And I'm not sure whether that's the same way I'm using it, but we can have a discussion about that. And there is also then the whole question of the Enlightenment and where is the Enlightenment and whose Enlightenment, which we will have to address at some point. Anyway, so this paper is drawn from a broader book, which is a synthetic book, which relies on the work of many other scholars, which is a long-durée environmental history of the Indian Ocean. And as I have already said, I am trying to use this concept of fragments. So I'm using fragments to highlight the things in view, which are in view in this work, which are not commodities or even commoditized. And I'm also using fragments as an alternative to objects, in the sense of the stuff which ends up in museums and which becomes charismatic. Because a lot of the things, I mean, I'm not dismissing the insights of commodity history and object history, and the way material culture studies, as we know now quite well, is rerouting global history to attend quite carefully to the micro, the specific, and then to kind of work through broader relations, production and consumption, for instance, through the material culture. But really, I'm using fragments to say, let's think about this other class of things, which doesn't follow the traditional pathways of the stuff that we refer to as a commodity or an object. So by fragments, I mean that this stuff comes from the intimate and granular interface of the human and nature. The stuff is often passable, maybe invisible, sometimes invisible, I've got here, sometimes quite earthy, watery. It isn't really fulsome as an object. Rather, it can be quite flaky in its materiality. And so these fragments have not been of traditional interest to many scholars working in archives or museums, or indeed to intellectual historians. But their persistence over the long term, despite their smallness, and one of the things I hopefully will get time to get onto is very slippery, I should say, their durability when worked up and cast as technique in human hands, and then their ability to build up to broader structures. We can think here of capitalism, we can think of religion, but here I really should think of enlightenment. And the way they create the fragments, material composites and symbolic associations with other materials, but also critically here, and I really want to keep, this is not a post-human history, I want to keep the human frame, the sensory human frame, in view in what I say. All of this means that maybe we should pay a bit more attention to this stuff. And to be clear, what I'm arguing for here is that enlightenment ideas, given our theme, also can come from the engagement of human beings with this stuff in the watery environment of the Indian Ocean. So in other words, I seek here to approach the history of ideas from this interface of the human body and material culture. Now, I could discuss, but I won't discuss here, why these things have gone missing in our disciplinary cognates. There are all kinds of disciplines that came into this space, which carved out the terrain, which meant that this stuff actually went elsewhere. And so you could say that, you know, historians of science didn't look at them, but other historians were not interested in them as well. And so there is a kind of intellectual reason for that, for why they went missing through the modern period, which may be interesting. But really, I have to kind of introduce the Indian Ocean as a three-dimensional space, and to insist that it's actually kind of a critical space for us to consider in thinking about the Enlightenment as well. So really, as we approach Latin America in the last paper, what I'm trying to do is to kind of locate the intellectual history in this pulsating geography of the Indian Ocean. One estimate, after all, is that 3 of 5 people face the Indian Ocean. And of course, we don't need to think very, very much about the news at the moment to understand that this ocean and its passageways and straits are really, really significant to where we are right now. So really, the kind of broader premise is that this is a very good place to test the history of human engagements with more than human things. So let me get going with... those are just some images just to kind of give you a sense of the broader contemporary context, which I think are important politically to kind of thinking through what's going on in the Indian Ocean. I'm currently kind of working on Colombo, as I think Neil mentioned, and this is what's going on in Colombo. And one of the fragments later in the book, it won't appear here today because I'm interested mostly in the 18th and 19th century because of the remit of this conference. But sand actually is something that I've been thinking a lot about and the dredging work that's going on in Colombo. And really, this is a sort of invisible substance, which is really reshaping the geography of the Indian Ocean quite literally and other geographies elsewhere as well. And certainly one could think, you know, about the politics of refugees and the centrality of the Indian Ocean to that story as well as another contemporary context, which is really, really important in understanding why the Indian Ocean matters to our discussions. Anyway, this is the structure of what I'm going to say in the remaining bits of the talk. I'm going to kind of structure it in 3 steps. I mean, I could start earlier, but I'm going to talk about scalar jumps, then tall tales and deep thinking. And in each case, I'll be working with a particular fragment. And in the first case, I'm going to be working with kauri shells. So kauri was a currency that was central to the globalization of the Indian Ocean economy, and so a means of learning how to exchange. But here what I want to do is to actually kind of locate it next to the human frame as a shell which was located in a series of relations to the human body. There was a sequence of relations which was about jumping from the small, the gendered shell, to the big, the sprawling economy in the history of the kauri shell. As the shell was cast into material exchanges of all kinds, it was also a site for working out ideas of human difference. And the kauri links writing of all kinds across the Indian Ocean arena. It allows us to pluralize the cultural origins of something called enlightenment. The second step following the scalar jump I call tall tales. Here, I mean, it's a prevalent way of historical writing in the Indian Ocean to track the spread of religion, like Islam gelling the Indian Ocean, or Buddhism traveling across the Indian Ocean, or various kinds of Hinduism, and maybe kind of knowledge economies more broadly. But I want to kind of work with tale-telling here. And maybe even storytelling along several stretches of shore to get to how fragments can hold many conceptions of strangeness and otherness. And here the fragment I'll be working with is ambergris. Looking at ambergris is a way of tracking how narratives and cosmologies arose at the water face. This is also another way of thinking with enlightenment, not simply to pluralize it as a term and to find its origins in different places, but to tease it apart as a set of stories which are difficult to fold into one. And then finally, I want to end with colonial knowledge, because we're interested in that here, science, and European imperial global enlightenment, which is a particular kind of enlightenment, I want to say, and to kind of track that from the interface of the human and its surroundings. And here I'll be working with the title Deep Thoughts. I call these deep thoughts because they're about the Indian Ocean itself, about its unseen depths, but then also these deep thoughts are not simply translated into effective economies or knowledge systems. The deep thoughts are distracted and even partial in their epistemological reach. And here I think with the sea cucumber and think through the limits of European universal global thinking. The use of deep thoughts in some ways may then be ironic. They may be deep, but they're not efficacious. In the end, and in the light of the environmental politics of our present, the intervention highlights not the new precarity of the human condition, but how human precarity has been part and parcel of human engagement with the Indian Ocean through time, as small things led to these big changes, or as particular humans sought to see and study in idiosyncratic ways, but also in ways which were raced and gendered in exclusive and genocidal fashion. Essentially, human attempts to tame, subdue, experiment, control, and globalize their engagements with nature have been fallible, limited, and set upon in environmental terms. And this, too, is in keeping with the focus on the fragmentary and the possibility that this fragmentary method may open up a few new insights in our thinking. So, a sack made from palm leaf and lined with coconut fiber, with cowrie shells, the money of the Maldives, as content in the shape of a sugar loaf, height 47 centimeters. That's a catalogue entry for an object in the Welt Museum in Vienna, which has recently been studied and recuperated by an anthropologist, Eva Maria Knoll, who I cite here. I found the object myself with its keeper's guidance, and actually what was really super interesting, given the previous presentation, that there were loads of musical instruments next to it, and we might want to think about this, because I noticed the flutes and some of the descriptions had actually a binding as well was mentioned. The flutes were bound, and this object is bound by coconut coir, by the way, and it's kind of, you know, palm leaf from the coconut, which wraps up this object. So it's an ethnographic object collected by Carl Wilhelm Rosset, a German explorer and collector who got it from the Maldives in the late 19th century. This was around the time that the Maldives became a British protectorate. It's 14.5 kilograms in weight, rather heavy to carry, and it's thought to be a quarta, a collection of 12,000 cowrie shells, taken to be a standard sum of exchange. The enormous number of shells it carries is now proving too much as we carried it. Actually, some of the shells fell out. And you can see the shells peeping out of the crevices, which are now appearing in the coconut coir lining of the sack. So just to give a sort of brief introduction before I get into the sort of intervention, it was in South Asia, and in Bengal in particular, that cowrie became a currency. Cowrie was first noted for its use as money in India by the Chinese pilgrim Fa Cien at the start of the 5th century. Metal coins served as currency alongside cowrie in Bengal at this time. But the shortage of metal coins allowed cowrie to evolve from the currency of choice for low-level and perhaps localized exchange to become the prime medium of exchange between the 8th and 12th centuries. As time passed, by the 13th century, cowrie once again worked together with silver and gold. The formation and strengthening of the Bengal Sultanate, the state that lasted till the 16th century, saw the introduction of the silver tanka coin. Finally, it was the British in India who oversaw the decline of cowrie as money. This occurred even as the abolition of the slave trade elsewhere saw the demise of cowrie's use as currency in slavery. If India was central to the emergence of this currency, and this is what I really want to get to, it was the Maldives which was the chief supplier of cowrie shells to India. The link between the Maldives and Bengal comprised an economic subsystem, which in turn was globalized. The Maldives captured the role as chief supplier of the shell in global trade, seeing cowrie become, as described in here, I don't endorse this necessarily because we don't endorse firsts, but enthusiasts call it the world's first global currency. This was partly due to the fact that the Maldives was a point of transit in the middle of the Indian Ocean for people moving from the east to the west or the other way around. It marked a pattern of transit between two monsoon systems on either side too. It was also known for this rope, the coir rope, which I mentioned, which is something I'm interested in elsewhere in the book. It tied up the bag in the Welt Museum. It was used for stitching boats, for instance, interestingly. And so, of course, that's one reason why it became quite central, the Maldives, to this economy. The Maldives' conversion to Islam helps facilitate the centrality of these islands. Yet what I want to do now is to actually kind of read this more from a gendered kind of lens and from the interface of the human body with this shell by taking the physicality of this shell seriously. And given our focus here on enlightenment, Maybe one place to begin would be Ibn Battuta, the idiosyncratic observer of the early modern Indian Ocean. He was born in Morocco to a family of Qadis, Muslim judges, and then he went on the Hajj, and he traveled very, very widely, beginning his travels in 1325. And so he writes of the Maldives, and then he kind of partakes in a trope, which is very common, which is to sexualize the natural products, and especially the coconuts and fish, and their effect on sex in the Maldives. And that's something that comes up repeatedly in various forms of writing about the Maldives. But of course, he has very patriarchal relations with women. He's an enforcer of Maliki law. But he has enslaved women traveling with him to meet his sexual needs as well. So we've got to think about the violence of his writing from that perspective. And then in a sense, what this opens up is a whole landscape of people who kind of repeat this trope of the sexualization of the Maldives. But then what emerges in the writing is the role of women in fishing the shells from the lagoons, in addition to men at times, but really that this is a place which is really central to, it's a matrilineal place, even as it kind of converts to Islam, right? And so the matrilineal of this place is really, really important to keep in mind, even as outsiders, Ibn Battuta, but also Europeans who come into this landscape, start to exoticize it and misunderstand the gender norms which are operating here. So the inhabitants of these islands, this is Battuta, use curry shells as money. The mollusk, they sell them in exchange for rice to the people of Bengal, who also use them as money. And then he noted their use as ballast in ships by the Yemenites. And he also referred to curry's use as currency in the trade in enslaved peoples. So if we move forward some centuries, we have a Frenchman, Francois Pirard, who spent 5 years in the Maldives, 1602, after a shipwreck. And he follows Ibn Battuta's similar tropes, coconut trees, fish. And then he adds this line, twice a month, 3 days before and 3 days after the new moon, as well as at the full moon, women gathered them on the sands in the water up to the waist. He noted that he had seen 30 or 40 whole ships loaded with them without other cargo. So in addition to the role of women in fishing the curry from the lagoons, curry was associated with fertility right across this world. And this comes from the way the shell is serrated. But there are other associations which are found from the Middle East to East Asia. It's associated with fertility. It was also seen to chase away the evil eye, from again how it was seen to be a half-closed eye. So the shape of the shell, I want to argue, and the feel of the shell affected the kind of human relationship that arose around this product of the Indian Ocean. Meanwhile, all of this sat together with really the kind of confused sort of gender norms which were applied to a place like the Maldives. I mean, even Ibn Battuta said, it's a strange thing about these islands that their ruler is a woman, Khadija, daughter of Sultan Jalal al-Din Omar. Now, there are a lot of points I made very, very quickly here, so I want to kind of bring this together very quickly. This is like just a small sketch. But really, what I'm saying is that these curry shells were symbolic and even erotic, possibly, and that sort of gendered kind of story sits alongside the rise of this object, this fragmentary thing, to the status of currency. And so here we have a succession of definitions of the human here, allowing me to think of this as what I'm calling a scalar jump, and not simply in narrowly economic terms. The woman collector of the shells in a site which had seen matrilineal, the collected shell as feminine, in addition to a whole series of other symbolic repertoires, the arch collector of the shells, I didn't say this, but this is the case, the arch collector of the shells is the queen of the Maldives, which is a recurrent trope in early modern European naturalist texts, the queen who has a treasury of curry, and then the rise of a global human system of exchange from the locally oceanic, which includes, by the way, the inhuman system of enslavement as well. So there we go. That's step one. I'm not going to look at my time very quickly. Step two, and here I want to work with ambergris. So it's it's tempting to think that knowledge systems and religious systems in particular, which is the prevalent historiographical trope, unite the Indian Ocean. But here I want to kind of think about ambergris. And here I don't want to think about the standardization of connections, but really the sort of strange symmetry between tales around this alluring substance which circulated across the Indian Ocean. If the Kauri story and the Maldives attempted to point to the origins of thought about nature from multiple vantage points, this one seeks to think through parallels and divergences around what may conceivably be called Enlightenment thinking. So take the account penned by Al-Masudi, who was born in Baghdad in 890 CE and died in Egypt from where he wrote in 956 CE. In his writing, ambergris is peppered across the geography of the Indian Ocean. In sketching various seas in the Indian Ocean, Al-Masudi described the Arabian Sea as the Sea of Larwi. There is little ambergris in this sea, for most of it is found on the Zanj coast, East Africa, and in Al-Shihir, Southern Arabia. He carried on that some of the best ambergris is found in the islands of Zabaj, today's Indonesia. He described the ambergris of this region, and here I'm relying on translation. It's round, pale blue, and sometimes the size of an ostrich egg or smaller. Some pieces are swallowed by whales, of which we have already spoken. When the sea is rough, the whale vomits pieces of ambergris, sometimes the size of a piece of mountain, sometimes of the smaller size we have mentioned. Swallowing the ambergris kills the whale, and its corpse floats on the water. Al-Masudi described how the people of today's Southeast Asia hunted whales in search for ambergris in little boats, and how they open the belly of the whales to extract the ambergris. He differentiated the ambergris found within the whale's intestines and that found near its back. The former was known to the druggists of Iraq and Persia, who call it nard. That which is found near its back is much purer. The longer it has been inside its body, the purer it is. Now, this becomes a kind of geographical exercise about placing, you know, where does the ambergris come from? Presumably people know already what ambergris is, but I mean, one of the things is that people in this period are trying to figure out what ambergris is. And so all kinds of tales arise, you know, is it from the depths of the sea? Are there trees at the depths of the sea which give rise to the ambergris? And it's a series of tales which are told, which operate alongside, in fact, Al-Masudi himself refers to the female ruler of the Maldives keeping a treasury of kauri shells. And so as this is going on, actually you get the same sort of thing, but slightly different, happening from the East Asian end, because ambergris is there from the start of the connection between the Middle East and East Asia via trade, and it's there in East Asian texts dating from 860 CE onwards. It's mentioned in the literature of the Song era. But here what we have is a kind of equation with dragon's spittle from the early 12th century. One account provides the story of dragons who make ambergris. When a dragon lies sleeping on a rock in the ocean, the dragon, spittle which floats on the water, flocks of birds hover over the spot, and shoals of fish gather to feed on the substance. When they see this happening, the local folk enter into the sea to gather ambergris. Now, this is, in some ways, I like saying this, this is whale shit, which becomes human perfume, right? So in a sense, it's a deeply sensory thing, but kind of bizarrely so, and it becomes one of the most precious commodities in our world today, because of the perfume trade. But really what's going on here then is European science coming into this terrain and really trying to make a matter of fact in this space. And so really, I mean, once we move forward, I mean, we have all of these tales circulating from East Asia and from the Middle East, and they're partly cartographic tales. You know, why is the ambergris found in certain places? I mean, now we know that the currents are actually really central to where ambergris is found and where it kind of lands in the shore. But really it also becomes, you know, is there an island in Southeast Asia, which is the mountain of the ambergris? And, you know, is that ambergris island? And so it actually becomes deeply cartographic and deeply intercultural. And then into this, of course, comes a lot of violence and killing, because really then what gets tied up in this story is the history of whaling, right? And so people go hunting whales in great number around this trade. And it's also central, really, one could argue, to scientific quarries in metropolitan capitals as well. So one could think of Robert Boyle, for instance, trying to kind of create a theory of ambergris. He was particularly curious about ambergris and experimented on it. But at the end, he was willing to set his conjectures to one side and follow the view presented in a journal seized from a Dutch East India prize, meaning a captured vessel. In bowing to the field account of the ambergris, Boyle was seeking to establish a matter of fact. And here, I mean, you can read this. The matter of fact is not really a fact at all. This is, again, a narration. So really the kind of slipperiness of fact-making and the fact that this fact-making is going together with whaling as well, and the necessity to actually kind of extract the ambergris from the whales, which are being killed in great number. Now, finally, I don't have a huge amount of time, but I do want to do deep thinking, because this is relevant to this conference. And here I want to kind of work with sea cucumber, or bêche de mer, also called trepang. I mean, one of the problems here is that, you know, there's a dizzying range of species here of holothurians, and the creatures are found in many regions. They're richly present in concentration in Southeast Asian waters. And this is a very slippery creature, very slippery to cast into a historical narrative. It's slippery to pin down in scientific terms. And then it becomes a trading commodity. I mean, so far what I've tried to do is to pluralize the Enlightenment, to disperse it over the waters of the Indian Ocean. But we have to attend to the forceful elements of colonialism and imperialism and that Enlightenment coming into these waters as well. But that Enlightenment, despite being kind of forceful and colonial, is strangely limited, because really what it's interested in this landscape is in spices. And the spices, which are tied up here, one can bring to mind, for instance, Dutch Empire and botanical interests and botanical gardens and Amsterdam, the rise of Amsterdam as an international center for botany. And that whole trade and that whole interest is going in one direction, which is east to west. And this slippery creature is actually kind of going in a totally different direction, because what's going on is that it's being fished in Southeast Asia, sometimes at the coast of Northern Australia, we now know, because of wonderful work by archaeologists with various sorts of images on the north coast of Australia. But it's been shipped, you know, from the south north and into East Asia, and it actually kind of jumps from island to island as it goes, as it's processed and as it's dried. And in East Asia, it actually is used for taste, but it's also an aphrodisiac. So it really kind of ties together, once again, the way these substances actually open up human relations with nature, which, you know, are unexpected and which don't fold into the way we normally think about the categories of human nature interactions, where, you know, in a sense, a lot of writing on recently, for instance, people have described, here I'm thinking of Amitav Ghosh, genocide in this landscape being tied to the plantation system. But this is a story that's actually kind of, you know, at 90 degrees to that one, and it's going in a different direction totally. And really here, I mean, one of the people, I don't have a huge amount of time here, so I'm going to do this very quickly, is someone who, you know, other people in the room have written about as well, which is who's Rumpf, who is the Dutch naturalist, who writes, you know, very evocatively about the natural history of Southeast Asia, and his texts are really foundational to the origins of European natural historical knowledge of this landscape. And he writes about the undersea as well. And one thing that's super interesting about him is that he is going increasingly blind, right? And so he's actually having to exert his senses in new ways to kind of comprehend the natural history around him. This includes a reliance on a whole series of intermediaries, and there's a rich literature on this. But I would argue that actually the undersea provides a kind of space for him to kind of actually theorize because of his sensory capacities and limitations. So for instance, he writes about the big white water with the new or dark moon in August, which lasts until September. The entire sea around Banda, as far as the eye can see, shines white and bright. So here what I'm trying to do is to kind of partly say that, you know, rather than having the universal enlightenment eye, let's think actually about the kind of specific local kind of sensory dimensions of the engagement between the human being and the human observer and the space of Southeast Asia. I mean, he writes, for instance, about things coming up like excrement on the beach. He writes about sulfurous stench. I mean, I could go on like this for a very long time, but I won't. And then, of course, he writes about sea cucumber and what he does there. And this is, you know, disturbing and racist. He actually describes it in relation to the human penis. And he then kind of starts to do this thing, which is the racist sort of classificatory thing of comparing penis sizes and thinking about racial typology. So really what happens there is not a romantic cosmopolitanism here, and I kind of question the use of cosmopolitanism here, but rather a kind of series of forms of violence operating here. He himself has enslaved people in his household, by the way, and they are crucial as intermediaries, though he doesn't often credit them for his knowledge, relying instead on other elite informants in Southeast Asia. So really, and if we bring in the Australian Aboriginal communities on the North Coast, that kind of complicates things even further, and that's another kind of axis that really we have to insist on as really central to the sea cucumber trade. Let me conclude before I kind of run out of time. This is an unusually long history of the Indian Ocean. I could have spoken for longer, but it's been really compressed. But it's a history of the Indian Ocean which foregrounds environmental fragments, the term I'm using for now, and the frameworks and ideas which arise out of them. I could multiply cases and objects, but really it's not a kind of universal history. The stuff becomes attractive to humans or tradable in human hands and on the sea. It's not material cultural in a traditional sense, as it is working with stuff which operates at the borders of the human and which help demarcate what it means to be human in the sea. These fragments and elements show how the natural serve as a context to invent, differentiate, typecast the human. Interhuman relations come to be at this intersection. And these things show how storytelling and narration, there are attempts to make it fact. But thought and fact is also a new form of narration. Experimentation, killing, and genocide were directed simultaneously across this boundary of the human and more than human. Sensing, sexualizing, gendering, racing the human body was central to understanding of nature. And these fragmentary histories have often, though not always, there is literature on this stuff, eluded and worked beyond European and colonial imaginaries and their itineraries and modes of knowledge. Enlightenment here is plural, it's dispersed and limited in keeping with the fragmentary method. In this sense, this is an attempt to ground global environmental history and the history of the Indian Ocean in this pulsating geography. And it's an experiment in starting with passable, forgotten scraps, even, you know, rubbish in some ways, to show the contingent and layered associations and itineraries that have led to the present moment. It's a move against teleological and universalizing global histories, a stand against totalizing concepts such as the Anthropocene. It's also an attempt to build a different kind of historical story, not which is data-driven alone, or which is simply attentive, or which dumps terms like imperialism or enlightenment onto the history, but which rather thinks at this sort of ground level, at the interface of the human and more than human. It's not a post-human history, for it seeks to keep the human sensory and imaginative project, the work of humanity as labor, sharply in view. Yet it seeks to locate itself at the margins of the human and the place where the human meets the oceanic landscape to reveal how ideas come to be. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.